was kicking off today talking about eye health. It's a real pleasure to welcome to the show Katie Nalos, head orthoptist and education lead at Moorfields Eye Hospital Dubai. Hello, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And alongside Paola Salvetti, clinical lead of aviation medicine, consultant ophthalmologist, specialist in medical retina at Moorfields Eye Hospital Dubai. Hello to you.
Good morning, Suzanne.
It's great to have you in the studio, ladies. Shedding light, literally, on our eyes and vision and what happens behind the eye as well to keep us healthy. We're going to be taking a look at dry eye and also blue light and VDUs. And are you somebody that suffers sometimes with eye strain? Maybe you do a lot of close work, maybe you're on the computer a lot in the office. You may even get headaches. So we'll be taking a look at that as well. And August marks Child Eye Health and Safety Awareness Month. So concerns for the children, we will be looking at the health of eyes in kids today as well. But first off, Katie, explain to me, orthoptist, what's your role?
So an orthoptist is a specialist in binocular vision, so how the two eyes work together as a pair. So we deal with anything related to how the two eyes work in conjunction with another. We're also specialists in paediatric visual development.
So when you say how the two eyes work together, what do you mean? As in you need both of them?
So yeah, most people who have normal visual development use their two eyes as a pair to see in 3D. So you get the image from one eye, the image from the other eye, and the brain puts those two images together to give you depth perception.
Okay, elaborate a little bit more on that in layman's terms.
So so without the two eyes, you can't see in 3D, essentially, in a normal fashion.
And I guess, you know, that's what we do, isn't it? I mean, these are often the things on the show that we come across. It's the things that we almost take for granted, you know, breathing, seeing, tasting, things that we just do without thinking until something goes wrong. And so we start to notice things perhaps aren't quite right.
Absolutely. I mean, child's vision health is one of those things that I would really like to push the awareness of. Children do need to have an assessment because often they don't complain about their vision, so they don't know that they're not seeing things in the way that they should be seeing. Sometimes you can see problems, so a squint, so a turn in the eye can be indicative of a problem, and most people would get that checked out. But very small squints or even problems that you can't necessarily see needs to be picked up by a healthcare professional.
And for you, Paola, so ophthalmologist, doctor when it comes to eye health, what comes under your remit?
Well, basically, everything that relates to eye health, and it can be anything from blurred vision or any other symptoms pertaining to the eye, seeing things like wavy lines or things like that.
But this is more than just going to have your eyes tested because maybe you're short-sighted.
Well, sometimes symptoms can be because people are short-sighted or far-sighted and they don't necessarily realise that not correcting a visual defect has implications on their scratchy eye or their itchy eye or their fatigue. But then obviously sometimes people complain of more serious things and that can be related to more serious problems.
You're also, as in your title, clinical lead of aviation medicine. So tell me about that.
Well, aviation medicine is a sort of an occupational medicine. It's an extremely interesting part of medicine. We basically provide services to all aircrew personnel, or basically to all the personnel whose license is regulated by the GCAA, which is the General Civil Aviation Authority in the UAE, basically pilots, cabin crews and air traffic controllers.
So they have to go through an organisation like Moorfields Dubai?
Well, not necessarily Moorfields Dubai, but they have to go through a doctor which is approved, is an approved specialist by the GCAA. That is very important because the GCAA basically wants to make sure the doctor that see the flying personnel are aware of the implication aeromedically and are aware of the regulation that is around, for example, prescribing medicines to these people or having them go through a surgical intervention, things like this.
So if you had a pilot that was taking medication for one thing, you'd need to know, or even if you were taking medication to do with the eyes, you could have side effects. So everything you need, the whole being needs to be
absolutely
assessed.
And there is also actually a list of accepted medication by the GCA. There are medications which are normally prescribed by doctors for a specific condition, which actually do carry the risk of side effects for which the GCA deems them not to be approved. So not every medication that is actually available in the UAE is available to the pilot or to the flying personnel.
Very interesting indeed. Is it the case then that I'm assuming that a pilot's eye health, are you assessed in the same way as everybody else? Or I mean, you know, because I think I've not been in the cockpit of a plane, but you're not looking out, you're looking at a desk like we might be looking, rather like I'm here actually. I've got a big desk in front of me with lots of faders and lights and switches and buttons.
Exactly. Actually, pilots are assessed rather differently because they are confronted with a very crowded and visually complex environment, and their brain has to filter out the relevant information. So it's not just about visual acuity, it's about how the visual process comes about and how this interacts with other senses, because there is one fundamental difference when you're up there in the air as opposed to being here, which does come into play in how your visual perception is. And that is basically when you are on ground, there is one force, gravity, that acts as a referential for everything. Whereas when you're up there, gravity is not there to tell you if you're up or down, and therefore the visual cues are more important in the visual perception. But this is one of the major risks for a pilot, which is spatial disorientation, and it is very relevant obviously to aviation and aviation safety.
And when we come back, we're going to be looking at dry eye. Interesting to see that dry eye is more common in women, and here coming out of the United States, 10-30% of the population have dry eye. I guess all of us at some point may have it, but understanding what it really is and what it could mean, what could be happening more deeper perhaps, or what it could lead to. Katie Naylor, head orthoptist and education lead, alongside Paola Salvetti, who's clinical lead of aviation medicine, consultant ophthalmologist and specialist in medical retina at Moorfields Eye Hospital, Dubai. Now let's look at dry eye. I don't know about you, but you know, we've got the air conditioning, maybe our climate, but I do wear glasses. I've got quite sensitive eyes, but you know, I do tend to rub them quite a lot. I'm quite aware of that. So tell me first off, what's the definition of dry eye?
Well, dry eye is a multifactorial disease which is characterized also by the presence of elevated inflammation and surface and disease of the surface of the eye.
So it's a disease?
Yes, it is. It's dry eye disease, and it's very prevalent in this region particularly. But what I really want to stress is that we're talking about a multifactorial thing. So there is no magic wand that one can wave and make it go away. There is not just one single drop, I will give you this medication and this will go. You have to understand what in each case are the factors that lead to the presence of the discomfort and try to undo them one at a time.
So is this more than just getting a dry eye, but actually it's called dry eye, but it's more than that?
Well, you could have any number of symptoms. You could have blurry vision, you could have itchy eyes, sandy eyes, the impression of your vision fluctuating, the impression of having really pain in your eyes, particularly when you open them in the morning, first thing in the morning. Eye strain when you fixate the screen for a long period of time. There are a number of symptoms, and not everyone manifests the same.
If you are showing those symptoms and you go to the pharmacy and get some eye drops, can you just sort that yourself? Because I think that's what most of us would do.
Well, to a degree, in some very light cases, just putting lubricants in the eye would work. But more often than not in Dubai, you get prescribed a vasoconstrictor to just make the eye go white, and that works very well if you want to be picture perfect on, you know, on your wedding day. But it doesn't work in the long run to really get rid of the problem. You really have to analyze what is behind it and then tackle the issues.
So understanding what it is, you know, a bit of irritation as opposed to dry eye and what that really, really means. Now, I'd mentioned before that apparently it's more prevalent in women than men. Is that the case?
It is slightly more prevalent in women than men for multifactorial reasons. One is hormonal. And
yes, basically hormonal balances can get into play. Nutrition gets into play. So, for example, women tend to be more prone to the call of the fat-free diet, except that we actually do need fats. We do need healthy fats and a right level of fats, but fats are used by our body to make cellular membranes and a number of other things. Carbohydrates actually are an integral part of the tear film. The mucin layer, which is at the base of the tear film, is done mostly by carbohydrate. That it's actually a long chain carbohydrates put together. So there are different things, but also in the UAE, one of the most relevant thing is the environmental factor. Air conditioning is really, really bad for your dry eye, particularly because people tend in order to seek relief from the heat, obviously, but they tend to keep the air conditioning at a very low temperature. And there are two sides to this. One is the dehydration that comes with it, and the dehydration is not always a conscious thing. People don't realize that the being inside all day in an air conditioning environment will dehydrate them. And the second thing is really the velocity with which the air flows out of the aircon. So if you're sitting in an office and your position is underneath the aircon opening, you may think it a blessing, but it might not do a lot of good for your dry eye. So one of the tips that we always give is add back some humidity into your environment. You can buy in the pharmacy, there are plenty of these options available, those humidifiers. And I always advise patients to keep, for example, one next to their bed, one next to the screen if they can in the office. That helps a lot.
So screen use as well is also a big factor. So people are spending far more time now in front of VDU screens, so that's visual display unit screens, and it has definitely been found on many research projects that people blink less when they're concentrated on a screen, which means that the natural lubrication of the eye is not as effective. You add that to then the AC and the environment, and you're in trouble. So we would also suggest having frequent breaks, and also just making sure that there isn't any other underlying problems with the eyes.
And blinking more then. So when you have a break, go and have a blink.
Well, I mean, just walking around makes you blink more anyway.
Right.
So if you go and make yourself a cup of tea, you're much more likely to blink a good few times. But making a conscious effort anyway to blink well using your VDU screen is not the worst idea.
I also advise patients always, if you're sitting down and you have to make a phone call, unless it's something that requires at the same time for you to look at data on the screen, look away from the screen. Just do your phone call and look outside the window at the end of the corridor, whatever you want, but just release the muscle tension in the eyes by breaking away from a near fixation point.
That's interesting in itself. Well, we've got to talk about this, haven't we, with regards to the amount of use of our phones and how we will sit looking at our phones. Maybe we're even looking at a TV screen, a tablet and a phone all at the same time, all within seconds of each other of an evening. How is that impacting our eyesight?
Well, if you imagine when you look at something close up to see something, your eyes have to converge. So therefore, your muscles of your eyes have to contract to get that convergence. But not only that, inside the eye, the lens inside the eye has to squeeze up to get that extra focusing. So again, the muscles of around the lens have to contract. So that's like holding a weight for a really extended period of time. If you then don't relax that every now and again, it gives these symptoms of fatigue, of eye strain, of headaches at times. So, you know, the fact that we are now using these screens so much more, exponentially more than we were, say, you know, 10, 20 years ago, these things have to be considered, and we need to be making sure that we're considering all of this with our eye health.
Is the research there yet to how it has actually impacted?
So yes, with VDUs, yes, it has. There's quite a lot with regard to the fact that there are many more people complaining of these near symptoms. There is loose evidence, because it's very, very difficult to look at this on a great scale, because there are so many different factors that you have to take into account. But there is a definite trend for people becoming more short-sighted. Now, the only thing that one of the main things that people have looked at is close work with that. So there was a huge study that they did in Eastern Asian countries, where there's a very, very high predisposition for high levels of myopia. They then looked at migration of these people to Australia, where people are outside more, they're not having to do so much close work at a young age, and the levels of myopia in those families reduced. So as I say, some of it is quite anecdotal, so we do have to take these things with a pinch of salt. But even, I think you'd agree, Paola, even within the clinic, in the last 14 years I've worked for Moorfields, I see so much more paediatric short-sightedness than I've ever had done before.
Absolutely. Also because, unfortunately, we spend so much time now. Kids at school are required to do their homework. Not everywhere, but definitely more so as they progress in their curriculum. But they are required to do a lot of homework on devices. And the problem is that when they have some leisure time, what do? They're still on the screen. And that is where, obviously, it becomes complicated. Now, the other flip of the coin of the progressive augmentation of short-sightedness because of the screen time is that on the other side, there are the far-sighted people who never complain of not seeing unwell, but they complain of different type of strain, sensitivity to light, fluctuating vision, headaches, and they spend more time on the screen. Now, the reason for that is that whilst a short-sighted person will always complain of being visually uncomfortable and he will seek advice and we will give the prescription to them, the far-sighted people almost never complain about not seeing well and therefore do not seek advice. Now, they don't, because the brain automatically makes them compensate for the defect by using the muscles inside the eye. But as Katie pointed out before, when you're fixating the screen, you're already overusing that system. So if you're using the system say on overtime to compensate for the glasses that you're not wearing, and on top you add the long hours on the screen, you get a potentially explosive situation.
I'm learning a lot today about what's going on behind the symptoms. So whether it's the dry eye, what it could mean, and it's actually a disease. Fascinating, at the top of the show, talking about aviation and pilots and what needs to be considered there when it comes to the regulation and getting the correct checks for their eye health. So if you've just tuned in, you want to hear the show in full, you can always pick up the podcast later, as you can for all our shows at Dubai Eye. Just go to DubaiEye1038.com and click on the podcast page there. Questions coming in for Paola and Katie. One here saying, good morning, I'm pregnant and I need your advice on what I can do to get the best possible results for my baby when it comes to their eye health. My concern is due to low eye vision genetics in my husband, from my husband's side of the family. My husband's eye numbers are 7 and 8. I don't wear glasses. Is there anything I can do to prevent passing my husband's genetics to my baby if possible?
So, unfortunately, Probably not is the answer to that. I'm going to assume that those numbers are a minus, which is highly likely and much more likely than them being plus. It's probably already there. Genetics are genetics. So, and short-sightedness does tend to run in families. What we can do always with our young children is to make sure that they're very well visually stimulated when they're first born, because children's vision develops very quickly in the first few months of life. And then following on from that, and what we were talking about earlier, making sure that they aren't always doing close work, that they're doing lots of outside tasks that may possibly bring down the amount of short-sightedness that child might end up having. But unfortunately, there is very little we can do about genetic makeup. What I would say, however, is being short-sighted isn't actually the worst thing. You know, as long as you get the child checked when they're little, and if there is a need for glasses, get them wearing those glasses so that they can develop the best possible vision they can.
Well, hands up, I'm short-sighted, and my mother is short-sighted, so it was kind of known that my older brother, he started wearing glasses. You know, you're in the classroom, you have to keep moving closer. Back in the day when you had things like blackboards and chalkboards, and you just kept moving close to the front because you couldn't see, and that's exactly what happened to me 4 years behind my brother, around the same sort of age. So it is there, but we've come a long way. There's a lot that is being developed when it comes to correcting vision and how you can assist. There's some amazing glasses, you know, spectacle glasses designs out there, or contact lenses, but there's more than that as well, isn't there? Corrective eye surgery in some cases, it's not for all.
Absolutely, but it's definitely not suggested in younger children.
No, the reason being
is that you need to have a stable prescription before you can jump in and do anything about it. But absolutely, and short-sightedness is incredibly easy. I myself have had LASIK, so I'm a testament to it.
I had PRK. So.
What did you have?
PRK, which is the other possibility of doing the refractive surgery. Some people have very thin corneas and they cannot access the LASIK, but they could access PRK. So,
and you had the LASIK?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I didn't do either. I'm just wearing my glasses proudly. and I think I might be too old for it now. Is there an age limit to it?
Well, it's not as such as there is an age limit, but you have to consider that after about the age of 45, what we call presbyopia, or the requirement for a different correction for reading, kicks in. And at that point, it becomes complicated to correct both distance and near. Some people are very happy to keep correcting the distance and just keep their reading glasses. Other people are not happy with that. There is a solution called monovision, which is a very... very used at the moment. Basically, you correct your dominant eye for distance and you leave the non-dominant eye for near, but it's not a solution that will work for everyone across the board.
You have to have very strong binocular function, so your eyes need to be able to work very well together as a pair to be able to do that.
And also, you should not have any vestibular problem associated with this, because that's an absolute no-go.
When you go for an eye test, and you're talking about binocular vision, each eye is tested.
Yeah.
And, you know, we heard there about the -7 and -8. Can you give us an idea of the spectrum of what's considered?
So that is quite high. Generally speaking, people who are low myopes would be around the kind of 1, maybe 2 diopters. And those are people who can occasionally deal without their glasses, but end up squinting for distance. But people who are that short-sighted will be highly reliant on their glasses. They will. That's the first thing they will do when they wake up in the morning. They will be able to see very little without their glasses.
I would like to just pass a message, which is there are two different sides to this. One is that when we talk about -5, -6, -7, or +3, +4, that is actually the diopters, and that is the measurement of the lens that you need to correct the vision. That has nothing to do with the vision itself. You can still be 6'6 and see at the bottom of the chart, even with a -15.
You just need to be corrected.
Need to be corrected for it. So it's important to make people understand that the fact that they might require spectacles does not mean that necessarily that they will be visually diminished.
I see quite a lot of patients whose parents have brought them to us because they've been told that they're going to be blind, and it is simply that they just need glasses. And it's a really unfair thing to say to a parent. You know, all of these things, it's about same as it when you buy shoes for a child. You have to just make sure that their shoes fit their feet for their best possible outcome. Same with their glasses. You just need to make sure that they're in the best possible glasses to make sure that they get to their optimum level of vision.
Someone's texted in about contact lens. Is there a contact lens wearer they wear daily, is every day? Things they need to consider when it comes to dry eye.
Well, first and foremost, make it exactly to the analogy that Katie was making, make sure that the contact lens that you're wearing is actually the best possible contact lens for you. There is more to contact lenses than just the power. There are other parameters that need to be taken into account and that make for a perfect fitting. A good fitting contact lens normally can be worn for about 8 to 10 hours a day with no complication, provided that obviously you also try to control the environment. You don't put yourself in front of the air conditioning and all of these things. But first and foremost, make sure that the contact lens that you're wearing is actually the best one for you.
I used to wear contact lenses. I just can't be bothered with them, to be honest. And I actually found it often my eyes were irritated because they're quite sensitive. Dust, all, you know, air conditioning, all of that. Again, you know, now we're way down the line of contact lens science. What are we seeing today? Is there any negative side effects to being long-term contact lens wearers, you know, damaging the eye?
Well, if it's done, it's like with everything. If it's done properly and with measure, it's quite a safe thing to do, but it has to be done properly. So you have to make sure, for example, that when you blink, that the contact lens has to move, but not too much. You have to look at how the tear film distributes over the contact lens to make sure that it doesn't localize only on some areas of the contact lens, leaving other areas uncovered. So fitting of the contact lens is the most important thing, and obviously sensible wearing time. For example, of course you would wear them when you're outside the house, but on a Friday morning you're off work, avoid putting them in first thing in the morning. Just give yourself a break.
But they're far, far safer than they ever used to be. So way back maybe 20 years ago when they first came out, you couldn't get daily disposables.
Absolutely.
So the hygiene factor was a huge, huge factor involved in the safety of them. It was when I first started at Moorfields in London, 85% or something huge used to be of our A&E patients used to be from contact lens issues, and it was because of the fact that they hadn't cleaned their contact lenses often properly. But now with the daily disposables, essentially all you need to make sure is that you've got clean hands when you put them in and clean hands when you take them out, and that's it.
And also the materials obviously have evolved and we have better. We even have now progressive contact lenses, which we didn't used to have. We have contact lenses that correct astigmatism, which a few years, 20 years ago, were just not happening.
Yeah. Have you ever come across this? I'm just looking at the Washington Post here. Doctor finds 27 contact lenses lost in a woman's eye. 27?
Yeah.
I think I can remember sometimes thinking, have I got it out or not? I mean, it can sort of go around the back of the eye, but 27?
No, well, just to make things clear, it cannot go in the back of the eye because the conjunctiva is anatomically made in a way that there is a physical barrier between the interior and the back of and the posterior part of the orbit. But what can happen is that if they fold up multiple times, they can just get stuck in the forceps and in the fornix, and you can basically just take them out with some special tweezers, I would say.
Don't do that at home. No.
But if you have the doubt that your contact lens has not come out properly, by all means seek medical attention, because yes, it could be stuck in the eye, or more often than not, it actually has come out, but the foreign body sensation results from the fact that maybe by coming out, the contact lens has broken and has maybe scratched the cornea or done done something with it. So
lots of questions coming in. We'll address them when we come back. Questions coming in for my guests. Let's address them. One here regarding my wife has a lazy eye, and sometimes when I look at my 2-month-old, I think that maybe the baby might have it too. My question is, will this be permanent or is it normal for newborns?
So fleeting squints are quite normal in newborn babies up to the age of around 3 months. So if it's just a fleeting momentary thing, then it should just be monitored. However, that family history is significant. So if there's any concerns, it's probably worth them just getting checked out. If they stop seeing it and they don't see anything more, then probably coming around 18 months would still be safe for them to do. But if they do still keep seeing that turn in the eye, that squint, then definitely they need to seek medical attention, because the earlier you can pick these things up, the better the prognosis and outcome can be.
Okay, good. Also here regarding floaters, is there anything that can be done for floaters? There's a degeneration here that John's been diagnosed with. So what are floaters?
Well, floaters are basically portion of the gel inside the eye, the vitreous, that instead of being transparent, becomes visible because part of it collapses on itself, and it can some of these parts can detach from the mass or not. That determines how much the floater travels around the eye or kind of stays stuck pretty much in the same place. The short answer to this is that there's not much you can do about it. There is some laser that can be done in some particular cases, but first of all, the cases are very selected. And second of all, what the laser does is just breaks them up in smaller pieces. It doesn't take them away. So they are annoying if they're not associated with more worrisome symptoms like the presence of flashing lights or the impression of a curtain in one of the portion of the vision. Basically, the brain will learn to ignore them.
You know, you've mentioned a few times the brain and you know, the connection between the eyes and the brain. And, you know, I think we're more aware of that. You know, we talk a lot just when it comes to psychology and stress and how to manage the mind and quieten the mind. And I wonder if that's the same with, you know, that sort of taking time in the day to close the eyes, rest the eyes, is going to make a difference to our well-being. Never mind just eye health, but just general sense of well-being.
Well, I mean, you're taking into account the eye and the brain. The eye itself is only about a third of your visual perception. The rest is done in the brain. So it has got a huge connection. With regard to resting your eyes, you know, your eyes are the only thing that just by having them open, they're being exercised. They're constantly in use. They're constantly moving. And as we were saying, with the activities that people are doing nowadays, so much more close work, it's really important that you are taking frequent breaks, making sure that your eyes are at different distances, looking at different distances and not always focused on one thing like your iPhone.
That's a really good point, isn't it? I know we've talked about it before, but if you really focus on that a moment, if we are, you know, walking on the beach or if we're traveling and we're seeing great landscapes, but we're always looking down on a phone, we are taking away not only a great opportunity for a vista for the and a feast for the eyes, but actually we're changing the evolution of the eye in a way, because we're not using what's there. We're not, you know, it's underused,
which is one of the theories that people are becoming more short-sighted. So short-sighted is where your distance vision is blurred and your near vision is better, and because we're using less of our distance vision, it's as I say, one of the theories that myopic shift
it
in people
basically
is
tells you if you're only using near vision, what the message is being sent to the brain and to the body in general is basically that being short-sighted is an evolution advantage, and therefore the body adapts and people become more short-sighted.
So if you've got enemy coming from far away, you're not going to see them, are you? That's the future. Like, you know, where have we come from and where are we going? Isn't it interesting? Or maybe the enemy's closer, I don't know.
But going back to your point on quieting the mind, also there are there are some conditions in the back of the eye which can be related to high levels of stress. So just trying to quieting the mind can have an impact. Definitely, because it will change, quieting the mind, mindfulness and meditation do change the biochemical signals in your body. And the biochemical signals have an impact throughout, including the eye.
Question here. I have a power of -5 on both eyes and have thin corneas. My eyes have suddenly started rejecting contact lenses. Should I go for some sort of corrective surgery? I have broken many pairs of glasses playing football now.
Okay, this is a difficult one because the thin cornea does limit somehow the possibilities. Now, it depends how thin this thin is. So I would definitely advise this person to seek the opinion of a cornea and refractive surgeon specialist to assess what are the chances and the possibilities.
Someone's asking here, what would you recommend for children? Screen time then on a sort of daily basis.
Oh, this is going to make me very unpopular, isn't it? So we normally suggest frequent breaks is the most important thing. So it's not necessarily limiting the time, especially over the summer months. I would be very unpopular if I said to get rid of them completely, but limiting to 20 to 30 minutes maximum before having a short break is definitely the advice.
20 to 30 minutes.
Absolutely maximum before having a break. They can go back to it, but just
there
breaking
are also,
up the screen
there
time.
Are also theories linking the amount of time spent on the screen and the cognitive functions of the children. So one has to be aware of that too. So they do have an impact on the eye health, but they also do have an impact on attention, reaction, and other cognitive functions.
And sleep patterns as
and
well.
And sleep patterns, definitely.
We were talking before about blue light and how that affects all different aspects of the eye, but it also affects your sleep pattern. So we use blue light from the sun to regulate our sleep patterns, and we get that from screens. So if somebody's watching a screen just before they go to bed, they're going to find it difficult to sleep. So making sure that you have a good break before that children are going to bed from any kind of screen work. So that includes their phone, iPads, anything with a screen.
It's been a really fascinating hour. Thank you very much. Another one's just come in. Can I just squeeze this in? I have +2 eyesight, used to wear thick glasses. Stopped wearing glasses 9 years ago because the glass for +2 is too thick. Any recommendations? I have a squint if I focus or look at things far away.
I would say that this person does require a correction, and there are ways of making the glasses thinner, but obviously contact lenses would be an option for this person for most of the time. But definitely if there is also a squint, definitely it has to be evaluated properly, and probably full-time use of glasses is recommended.
Thank you very much for your time today, ladies. Katie Naylor, Head Orthoptist and Education Lead at Moorfields Eye Hospital Dubai, we thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thank you to Paola Salvetti's Clinical Lead of Aviation Medicine, Consultant Ophthalmologist, Specialist in Medical Retina at Moorfields Eye Hospital Dubai. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And
it's been a pleasure.
Enjoy your holiday. I know you're off on holiday now.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.